You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to the podcast that showcases the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food and drink. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, a TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Today, we're talking about wine, and specifically English wine. Production has surged in recent years. In 2012, 1 million bottles were produced, but in 2021, that had risen to 9 million bottles. But it's been a long road to get to that point, lots of bumps along the way, and we still struggle to compete with the French, the Italians, Spanish, and the New World, in market share at least. So what is the story of English wine? What role is climate change playing in that story? And what might be the future of English winemaking? To guide us through this is the fantastic Liz Sagess, wine columnist for the Ham and High series of newspapers, committee member of the Circle of Wine Writers, and author of books including A Celebration of English Wine and Sussex by the Glass. Liz, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Such a joy to have you. So let's just start off with a little bit about you. I gave you a small introduction, but you've got amazing credentials. When did your love affair with wine first begin?
Well, back in the late 1980s, the Ham and High was a marvellous paper in that journalists on it could write about everything, not just what was going on locally. And I used to write about my holidays and... One year in the Dordogne, I went to visit a winemaker and was fascinated. And I wrote about him when I came home. And I decided I wanted to learn more about wine altogether, and particularly about how to taste wine. Mm. So the paper had, unusually for a local paper, a wine correspondent. And he was very helpful in introducing me to the right people, directing me to tastings, getting me on a couple of courses. And it went on from then. I wrote the occasional article, but while the correspondent, Jack Cooper, was still working for the paper, I couldn't do very much. But when he had to retire, I took over, and I've been doing it ever since. Although I don't work full-time for the paper anymore, I do a regular monthly column. The last one went off to the paper last night.
Excellent. Keeping your hand in. I love that. Let's start looking at the history of winemaking in England. How long have we been making wine?
For 2,000 years. There's a tiny bit of dispute over whether the Romans actually made wine here, but there's a lot of good evidence indicating that they did. For example, there's a big vineyard, what is almost certainly a vineyard, unearthed by archaeologists in the Nene Valley in Northamptonshire, which could have been capable of producing something like 15,000 bottles a year. And we know that the Romans drank a lot of wine. The soldiers had an allocation of about a bottle a day, usually, when they were serving away from home. And specifically, in the latter part of the 3rd century, the Emperor Probus permitted people in England to grow vines and make wine. It was one of a number of specific areas that were allowed to grow vines. And so it's carried on from then.
Which might surprise some people in a way, but we'll come on to the modern history in just a moment. But traditionally, over hundreds of years, English wine has had a bit of a reputational problem, hasn't it?
Yes, it has, but it's a mixed reputation. For example, in the 12th century, William of Malmesbury said it was as good as the best French wine. And a few hundred years later, King John, however, went to visit the monks of Beaulieu who made wine, and he took one sip. I don't know whether he actually spat it out, but he turned to his staff and said, "Go forthwith to France and bring me back good wine." Someone else who liked it was Samuel Pepys, who, with some friends, drank wine from a vineyard in Walthamstow and declared it was better than any foreign wine they'd tasted. Yet fellow diarist John Evelyn was rather less complimentary. But on the other hand, he did write a lot about viticulture and winemaking. So he was clearly involved in it.
So the big question then really is, what what is it that's held English wine back for so long? I mean, was it the climate? You know, is the climate that much of a problem? Is it easy access to foreign wines? So, you know, there's a vast culture of winemaking, you know, a short row of boats away or a short sail away. Or is it the sheer lack of expertise and kit and culture?
It's climate a lot. Climate's had a lot to do with it. We're now just on the edge of sensible winemaking areas. In the past, it's been very difficult to ripen grapes properly here, which is probably why some of the older English wines were really not very palatable.
Yeah.
So it's partly that, but there's also been there has been access to French wines and other European wines all the time. Even in the time of the Romans, it's pretty certain they were importing wines from France. But then from and there have been import duty problems, though on the whole they've more worked in favour of English winemakers than against them in the early 19th century. For example, import duty on the equivalent of 6 modern bottles of wine was almost a pound, and that was a lot of money in those days.
Huge at the time, yeah.
Absolutely. So that did help English production. But I think it's also partly that until quite recently, we've been more of a beer nation than a wine-drinking nation. And wine wasn't for the masses. It was for the nobility and in the past for the religious orders, monks and so on. But now things have changed, both consumption and possibility of making a good wine here.
Mm. And just going back to the climate issue, so you say that it's difficult for grapes to ripen, and that's I guess that's a concept of sunshine and heat. But is it also the fact that Britain is just so flipping wet? Does that cause enormous problems to the winemaking process?
It does cause problems because there are two major mildewy vine diseases which reduce crops hugely and can taint the grapes. And we've always had problems with that through all English wine history, I think, as far as we know. There's also a mention of what decimated vineyards in Europe in the end of the 19th century, phylloxera, which is a little mite which eats vine roots. But I don't think that was a problem here. It's a disease rather than pests.
So the big question really for me is when it's such an uphill struggle to just achieve winemaking in the UK, why have people continued to try? Is it a romantic notion of the individualism of being able to do it ourselves? Is it bloody-mindedness? Or is it because people are thinking, oh, we might make a fortune, who knows? What's the thing that has driven people to keep trying in England?
Certainly not making a fortune. It is one of the areas where they say to make a fortune in wine, you need a much bigger fortune to start with. romantic, yes. People have loved that idea. I think basically in the past there wasn't a huge demand, so it was only people making it for their own consumption or there were very few commercial enterprises.
Almost
back.
Hobbyists.
Yes, and even after the revival of English wine in the 1950s, they were a lot of hobbyists rather than professional people with the right knowledge and expertise. Mm-hmm. And that's where the huge difference is now between the 1950s and 70s, where 60s, 70s, 80s, when it's all started growing. And today, when people know where to plant grapes, they know where how to look after them, and they know how to make good wine.
And I mean, this really leads us to the concept of English sparkling wine, and we've heard a little bit more over the last few years about champagne houses from France buying up specific types of soil, you know, in England to start growing their grapes. But when did English sparkling wine first appear on the scene, and what were the first reactions to it?
Well, we can go back to the 18th century for that, to a gentleman called Honourable Charles Hamilton, who planted a vineyard at Painshill Park in Surrey. And he first of all made red wine, which was harsh and horrid, and so he gave that up, made white wine. And it's bubbled. I don't quite know how it did. I don't think he did either, but he said it had a finer flavour than any champagne he'd ever drunk. So that was a good start. That was a one-off, though. Generally, English wine was still, unless for some reason it hadn't properly fermented and the winter temperatures stopped fermentation, and then it would re-ferment in the bottles in the spring. Mm. And there were two factors, again going back into history, which were crucial in sparkling wine. One was identifying the method to create a second fermentation in bottle, which is the classic champagne method and the method used in most English sparkling wine. And an English doctor called Christopher Merritt described that method by adding molasses to wine in a paper to the Royal Society in the middle of the 17th century. And shortly beforehand, an extraordinary English gentleman called Kenelm Digby, who had all sorts of interests, among them a glass factory, where he was able to make bottles thick enough and strong enough to not to explode when that second fermentation was taking place. Okay, so that's history. But going to modern English sparkling wine, there was a huge hiatus in English wine production between the outbreak of the First World War and the end of the Second World War. After that, there were a number of pioneers experimenting, one of whom was Raymond Barrington Brock, who was really the founder of modern English wine to a large extent. He did some experimentation with secondary fermentation sparkling wines. They were mixed reception with people he showed in the trade and journalists he showed them to. Then a few years later, in the early 1983, I think, Carr Taylor Vineyard in Hastings had a huge crop of Reichensteiner grapes, and they made the first commercial quantity of English bottle fermented sparkling wine. Mm. But it still wasn't champagne-like. So we need to move on until 1986, when an American couple, Sandy and Stuart Moss from Chicago, retired to the UK, bought the most beautiful Elizabethan manor house, Nye Timber, in Sussex, which Henry VIII had given to Anne of Cleves. And they bought it, and Sandy Moss had always wanted to have a vineyard, a small vineyard, but they determined that they would make not just any wine, but a sparkling wine that would be of equal quality to the best in the world. And the best in the world was champagne. Mm. So they planted the champagne varieties, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier, and they imported French expertise and French equipment. And they made sparkling wine, much to the scepticism of most of the English wine trade at that time. In 1992, they released their first vintage, which was put into a blind tasting of international sparkling wines in Paris, and it came out on top. There was astonishment all round.
I mean, it's hard to visualise quite how much of an impact, how much of a shock that was at the time, isn't it?
Yes, enormous. And then the following vintage won the title of Best Sparkling Wine in the World at a major wine competition. Mm. So that was the start of it. But hard on their heels, and before even their first vintages were released, other people were planting and making sparkling wine, particularly notably Ridgeview, also in Sussex, which has been so important in the story of English sparkling wine, because Mike Roberts, who founded it, was such a outgoing towards other producers person. He was helpful. He shared knowledge, expertise. Students came to the vineyard. He helped other people set up vineyards. And his family have continued that. So they have been crucial in the story of English wine.
Now, I mean, what's interesting about this is that when you go to France and you look at vineyards, especially places like the Languedoc, you see that winemaking is a very, very labour-intensive process. There are people in the fields. There's pruning. There's picking and treating, and the, you know, the tiny tractors that you've got to drive around. All these things, and it's very, very specific and enormous hard work as well. Look, and when you don't really have the culture of this, it's interesting. So, do we now have the workforce with the skills to pull this off, or are we still importing the know-how?
I think we've got the skills to do it because there are a lot of people now who have studied, gone around the world, learnt everywhere. And we have got a world-renowned agricultural college at Plumpton in Sussex with the wine department, which has students from all over the world and is really very highly thought of. But labour is a problem, and Brexit hasn't helped with that because particularly Romanian workers have been invaluable in the vineyards through pruning and harvesting, because you can do very little by hand in the sort of you can do very little by machine in the kind of vineyards there are in the UK. You haven't got these enormous flat areas where you can send machines through. I think there's only one vineyard I know of, well, maybe two, that have using mechanical harvesting. So mostly it's done by hand, and pruning has to be done by hand. So it's dedication and using volunteers. Lots of vineyards invite some of their customers to come and pick grapes for them. They're not so keen on doing pruning usually.
That's real work. I mean, that's really hard work, isn't it?
It's terribly hard work. I've done it even with a massive pair of electric secateurs.
So, a slightly tangential question for you. Now, the climate in the UK is very different from most winemaking areas. And I wondered what this means for the soil in the UK. So, does it mean that in the UK you need to use more or less agricultural inputs like fertilizer and pesticides, fungicides and things like that? Is winemaking a net contributor to soil quality? Or... And it's, again, part of this thing of the culture of the UK, having a certain, you know, as you say, we were beer drinkers. And is that because the soil led us to that? And now that we're beginning to do a lot more winemaking, has that shifted?
No, I don't think it's been a matter of soil, really. Soils for vines can grow just about anywhere.
They're tough things, aren't they?
There's a lot of talk about how we've got the same chalk subsoil as Champagne, which is true through a lot of southern England, the South and North Downs particularly. And there are very well-known English vineyards on the chalk. But they're also equally successful English vineyards on greensand and clay. It all depends on... drainage and exposition and microclimate, all sorts of things. And so as far as fertilizer is concerned, not a huge amount needs to be used because vines don't need enormous fertilization. But certainly it is a problem with fungicides. That quite a lot of that is used, and obviously that doesn't help soil quality. Organic viticulture is possible in the UK and is done successfully by a number of vineyards, so that can work. And there is a whole sustainability ethos now developing very strongly, so that wine wants to be seen as a green industry without causing damage to soils and so on. But it all depends on individual practices. And I think if you go really anywhere in the winemaking world, you can see almost side by side vines growing in beautiful, healthy looking soil with flowering cover crops alongside, and other ones where the soil is compacted and bare and just looks totally uninviting.
Yeah. And when you visit vineyards in France, the vineyard will say, "I have this iron rich soil. My hills point to the west, and that is why it's amazing." Literally, go to the other side, and they say, "Oh well, I have this very alkaline soil, and it's fantastic, and my hill points to the east. So that is why my." And so that's the terroir. Terroir is the romanticism rather than necessarily the minerality, I guess, isn't it? So
yes.
Okay. So we're talking very much about English wines, and I wonder just a quick question: is this a bit unfair? There are other nations in the Union. What are there Welsh wines, Northern Irish wines and Scottish wines as well? Or are they just too far north?
No, there's certainly Welsh wine. It's a small percentage of the overall UK production, but there's a very successful vineyards there. There have been vines planted in Scotland. I haven't heard of any wines or haven't tasted any wines that resulted, and I think it's very dodgy up there still. Similarly with Northern Ireland, but with climate change predictions, there's talk of some that by 2080 it'll be too hot to grow white grapes in the south of England, and so you'll be finding them on the hills in the north and in Scotland. That's maybe a bit extreme, but things are changing, so that will alter. But within England, there are vines just about everywhere. There's been a successful vineyard in Yorkshire since the 1980s, and there are others there. Cornwall, the West Country has got a good number of very good vineyards. The Midlands, and East Anglia is one of the fastest growing areas at the moment.
Yeah, it's always one of those strange paradoxical things that you kind of think, I can't talk about the benefits of global warming. I can't do it. And yet you can kind of go, we can grow some wine. But you feel really terrible that you've said it at all. Hello there, only me. I just want to break into the conversation to say that if you're enjoying this episode, then once it's finished, you might want to check out another edition. This one's all about the dark history of chocolate. You can find it at foodmatterslive.com. And now back to the chat. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the structure and the mechanics of English wine. Are there specific taste characteristics of a decent English wine, or is it about the way that it's produced and the way the fermentation has been controlled? I mean, is there a perception of English wine is generally like this?
Well, I think if you think of English white wine, because that's the bulk of the enormous bulk of the production, whether it's still or sparkling, there is a characteristic. There's a freshness in it because our grapes don't get as ripe as grapes in other countries, though they do now get pretty well ripened. So there's some acidity there. And if the grapes are very acidic, that can be particularly good in sparkling wine. So there's a freshness, and there's also a sort of an the English hedgerow of flowers character, a sort of light aromatic, a prettiness. It's always
you are
very
a romantic, aren't you, Liz? Quite right too. Quite right too. Okay, and then to go away from the romantic to look at the cash side of this, because we are a sort of an industry podcast. What is the state of the wine industry in England at the moment? How do we compare to other countries? I would say that my perception is that English wines are comparatively expensive. How is the industry doing?
It's doing okay. It's growing. Acreage of vines planted has increased by 150% in the last 10 years, and people are continuing to plant, so they have confidence in it. The expense is relative. England can never produce wines of a quality price ratio of places like Chile or parts of Australia or southern France. We just don't get the yields. Yield is a big problem in the UK. It's both low and it's very variable according to how the weather changes each year. But when the wines are of the quality they are, and these days, most English wine is of very high quality, particularly from all but the few hobbyist ones that remain. Some of those are still interesting, shall we say. But English wine is pretty reliable. And if you're thinking that you're getting a wine, if you're talking still wine, of a somewhat similar quality to Chablis or Sancerre, the prices aren't outrageous. It's very difficult to make an English wine and sell it, make any profit below £10. But the Wine Society does that, working with Three Choirs Vineyard in Gloucestershire, which has been, it's a long established vineyard, and therefore a lot of its setup costs have been absorbed. So that's a big issue, setup costs there. And labour costs are high here too. So you're talking, I think, if you're looking at a bottle of English still wine, £15 and more is realistic. Sparkling wine is still very, very good value compared to champagne, because if you consider the yields, the yield in here is much lower than in champagne. Yet you can buy English sparkling wine of similar quality to champagne at similar prices, and sometimes it's even cheaper. And there's the
there's a romanticism to buying English wine as well, and there's a lovely feeling to getting it. And I've been to a few vineyards. I mean, they seem to be people's. I mean, it's not a hobby, but it's people who love the idea. Are they now? Would you say that most vineyards in the UK are vanity projects or hobby projects where people aren't making a lot of money, or are there some people actually making some serious cash that can then invest and properly grow?
Yes, there are. There are a lot of people who've come in with a lot of money and poured money in, but usually with the intention of making money. But if you look at longer established vineyards, classic one is Camel Valley in Cornwall, established in the late 1980s. That has grown and grown over the years. They haven't borrowed money from anywhere. They've made small amounts, they put it back into the business. They've made some more, they put it back into the business. And that's an example of a second generation family business, a successful wine business in the UK. Ridgeview is similar. Now, that again has just carried on reinvesting a lot of its profits and creating a very viable business. Interestingly, one of the longest established English vineyards, Bolney Estate, has just been sold to an international group, Freshnet, which was looking for sparkling wine from England to add to its existing portfolio. And so they clearly, Freshnet is a big international company, clearly realises there is commercial potential in English wine.
Yeah. Is there a need, really, though, because of the sort of the scale being that much smaller in the UK, of the diversified vineyard, which you get a lot in South Africa, where you go along to a vineyard and there's a restaurant, there's a deli, it's a family experience, which is very different, really, to the experience in France, which is frankly a bit snottier. Apologies to all French vignerons, but there's a sense of you come along, yes, you can taste our wines, and then you go. And in the UK, I've been to a few vineyards which make a bigger experience of it. They talk about the story behind themselves a bit more, with a bit more relaxed. There's a cool restaurant with a big outside terrace. It's welcoming. Now, this is basically saying we have different income streams. We're a restaurant, you know. We're showing off that we've got vineyards as well, and we're not just a vineyard. Do you think that's an essential part of running an English vineyard? To have to be selling the experience and not just flogging the juice.
It's certainly important. Wine tourism is growing and growing here, and being much encouraged by Wine GB, the controlling body for wine here. But wine is the heart of it still, because people won't come on the whole to these vineyards if they don't. See the whole process, understand the wine, get something decent to drink. There are some projects which are really wedding venues with a few vines tagged on alongside. but I don't consider those the true story of English wine.
Yeah, absolutely.
But getting people to to go and experience it is the best way, because they understand, and they understand why it costs more. I went on a wine tour around one winery a while back with, and it was mostly young people, and young people are the main consumers of English wine, interestingly. And they were saying afterwards that, no, it wasn't going to be their everyday drinking wine, but now they appreciated it more and understood why it was so priced, they would be very happy and want to drink it on special occasions and celebrations and so on. So, yeah.
And you're buying a story as well, aren't you? And I think, you know, having an English wine at a wedding, for instance, when you when Englishness is at the fore, it's sort of all those things. It sounded a bit, you know, overly patriotic, but it makes sense. I get it. Now, but let's talk about red wines briefly. England does produce some red wines. Is it a growing sector? Is there any future in it, do you think?
Yes, there is. Again, this is to do with warmer climates, the good side of climate change. And there's quite a buzz about Pinot Noir, which in good years can make absolutely delicious red wines, a little bit lighter than most Burgundian styles, for example, but beautiful, pure fruit and aromatics. And there are also some decent red blends around from grapes that are less familiar to people, Dornfelder, Regent, Rondeau, for example. And they could be pretty good. But it's never going to be more than a small part, certainly for the next couple of decades, I would have thought. It's going to be centred on white with some rosé as well.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit just about sustainability. And we had our first certified sustainable wines released in the UK just last year. I presume that this is a growing area of interest for the winemakers and drinkers alike. I mean, if you can charge a premium and upgrade people, then surely there's a bit more business in it. What do you think about this?
Yes, and it's very largely consumer-led, this impetus. As I said, the consumers are a lot of younger people who are concerned about this side of the industry. And so it's led by them. Also some major retailers, for example, Waitrose and Marks and Spencers, who are very big supporters of English wine, are putting a bit of pressure on. And the export markets, because although export is only comparatively small at the moment, it needs to grow for English wine to continue to be a sustainable business in that sense,
Absolutely,
a commercial business.
The
biggest export market is Scandinavia, and they are very concerned about sustainability. So the initiative is led by the former head of the wine department at Plumpton College, who's been interested in this side of things for a long time. And they've gone down a route to try to be as inclusive as possible, because the business, the industry is very widely spread with small businesses, medium-sized businesses, and large businesses. And what works for one doesn't always work for the other. So they've got various standards, and they're setting a continuous cycle of improvement and sharing good practice and ideas and so on. So it will be developing. It's mostly been on the environmental side to start with, vineyards and so on. They're very concerned about the carbon footprint. They've got a very good carbon calculator, which they make freely available to anyone. And there's also there's quite good carbon sequestration in English vineyards, because there's lots of hedgerows and trees and stuff around.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
So so that helps. Yeah. And pressure to reduce chemical use, even not necessarily go fully organic. And also that cuts costs too, if you don't have to pour too many chemicals around.
Absolutely. Everything should help. Okay, well, that's all absolutely fantastic. So I've got one last question for you, really, and that is, what are you most excited about in English wine at the moment? Is there a particular vineyard, a particular wine? Is it the movement? Is it acceptance of the industry? What's the thing that fires you up?
Well, I think the fact that we can make really, really lovely wine in England, and wine which you can celebrate with. English sparkling wine is lovely. I like the freshness of it. It just puts you in a happy mood. And it's also the growing choice of still wines. They're going to become more and more interesting as time goes on. And I think you know, we've just got a good future ahead of us if the climate continues to be warm and the violent aspects of climate change, the strong winds, the rainstorms don't become too strong. Just keep our fingers crossed and encourage the lovely people who are making English wine, because they're a great group of people. They are very, very inclusive. They help each other. It's not a cutthroat commercial business like some places. Yeah. So if they keep going like that, I think as consumers, we've got a lot to look forward to.
Absolutely. Hear, hear. And you know, any listeners who are interested in that kind of thinking, oh, maybe I should go and see an English vineyard. I've only ever had a fantastic experience with some enthusiastic people there and often a great experience. Liz Seges, thank you so much for joining me.
Pleasure. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. For example, to learn about the fascinating past of one of the nation's favourite drinks, go to the site and search The History of Tea. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.